I'm your host, Megan Kamrick. New Mexico was among 31 states and the District of Columbia that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The number of people covered by the program in New Mexico has continued to grow and will reach more than 900,000 by the end of June. That's about 44% of the state's population. The federal government picks up most of the premium costs of the more than 200,000 people added to Medicaid under that expansion. But the amount the state spends on Medicaid continues to grow, and officials are struggling to find those funds amid an ongoing budget crunch. Also, the Trump administration wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which could affect people who got coverage through Medicaid. This show is part of our People, Power, and Democracy project, which explores ethics, transparency, and good government. It's funded by the Thornburg Foundation and by KUNM listeners. Joining us right now is Dr. Rick Madden. He's a physician in Belen. He has also served on an advisory committee on Medicaid at the state. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Madden.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of impact did you see on your practice and your patients with the expansion of Medicaid here in New Mexico?
It's been pretty remarkable. I've seen patients come in that I hadn't seen in years and some who I hadn't ever seen before because they lacked health insurance. And when they were able to get on health insurance through the Affordable Care Act and especially on Medicaid expansion, it made a real difference in their lives. I saw them bringing problems to me that they hadn't dealt with and should have dealt with for years, such as diabetes and hypertension. And the sense of relief was really palpable when they'd come into the office. It was just really heartwarming to know that they were going to be able to get the care they needed.
Do you have any particular patient stories that stand out for you that show how expanding this access to coverage made a difference to them?
Oh, I can think of several. One is a patient with diabetes who had retired. Her husband had retired as well, and she wasn't able to afford to come in, so she just asked me for refills by phone for over a year after the retirement until she was able to get onto insurance and was able to come in and be seen and resume the care that she needed.
And it's always ideal to do that rather than, I know doctors don't like to just keep giving prescriptions over the phone, especially if someone has a chronic illness.
Yeah, chronic diseases take their toll gradually and then sometimes suddenly after a period of time. And unfortunately, that kind of cost to the patient, both in terms of suffering but also financial cost, is huge. And that can be remedied by keeping continuous care.
So last year, the state put in some cuts to reimbursement rates to keep funding Medicaid. Did those hurt your practice? And what if that's something similar happens in this coming fiscal year?
I'm an employed physician with Presbyterian Medical Group in Belen, have been for a lot of years, and so I did not feel the impact that a private physician who is watching their own budget very carefully day to day. But it certainly has a big impact on any organization, no matter what their size, because they depend on the income that comes from payments for care on the fee-for-service basis or other kind of payment plans. So if 5% cut to primary care, as happened last fall, were to continue, that would tend to decrease the revenue and wouldn't allow businesses to extend the services that they should. That also can put small practices out of business. Medicaid doesn't pay that well anyway, and cutting 5% is a pretty big hit.
Also joining us today is Sarisha Mane. She's with the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty. Sarisha, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Is Dr. Madden's experience a representative example of the overall impact on New Mexicans accessing care through the Medicaid expansion?
Yes, absolutely. Let's remember that over 260,000 people gained coverage through the Medicaid expansion, and these were folks who for the most part, were uninsured before Medicaid expansion. And, you know, we were seeing at our nonprofit organization, our law firm, that we had patients who were coming in and had, you know, these tremendous bills, medical bills that they couldn't pay. You know, in some cases, I remember a client who had a $300,000 bill because he was uninsured from having gallbladder surgery and then complications after that. So Medicaid expansion has been a huge deal for all of the people who are now getting insurance through that program.
So do we need to come up with a minimum amount to fully fund Medicaid? What happens to the federal funds that match the state investment if we decrease how much we put in to Medicaid? So, am I asking that correctly?
Yes, I understand the question. So remember that Medicaid expansion was fully funded by the federal government for the first 3 years. So for 2014, 2015, and 2016, the federal government paid 100%, you know, of the costs.
For those additional people.
Exactly, for the additional adults who came in through Medicaid expansion. Starting in 2017, the federal contribution goes down or has gone down to 95%. So now the state pays 5% for the year of 2017. And then next year, 2018, it'll go down by another percentage point to 94% and then 93%. And then it stops at 90%. So at maximum, the state is going to be paying, you know, 10% of the costs for all of these folks, which is a very small amount. Considering, you know, the amount of people that we got covered through the Medicaid expansion. So yes, there is a state funding impact, you know, each year because of that. It's something that New Mexico was aware of when, you know, we first decided to adopt the Medicaid expansion. There's also a great amount of funding that comes into the state because of it as well. You know, sometimes people don't recognize that what happened because of all the federal funding that came into New Mexico, the state was actually making money off of Medicaid expansion because, you know, that money was going to insurance companies who were then paying premium taxes to the state. You know, it was going through gross receipts taxes coming back into the state. So we were actually seeing a surplus of funding for several years, and we're continuing to see that for a few years.
So I know we'll get into this later, but the Human Services Department has a level, like $42 million they say we need for Medicaid. You guys are seeking more.
Right.
If we don't reach a certain level, what does that mean? We start cutting services?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. So the Human Services Department.
Do we lose federal money as well because we're not?
Exactly.
Okay.
So the Human Services Department has said that for FY18, which is the next budget year coming up, they will need an additional $42 million of state funding above what they had last year. And that is because partly because the federal contribution is going down for Medicaid expansion. It's also because enrollment is going up for folks who are always eligible for Medicaid all along but are now, you know, getting enrolled in the program. You know, there's some amount of costs that go up because of medical inflation every year. So they've said $42 million is the amount that they would need to be able to keep services the same. So if the state underfunds Medicaid by any amount under that, then there's a strong possibility that there will be cuts to services. And unfortunately, because of all the cuts that have already happened over the past year, including to, you know, payment rates to healthcare providers that Dr. Bannon spoke about, you know, there's really no place left to go. And so, you know, the next step is for the Human Services Department to start cutting entire benefits like dental care or vision care. You know, they've already put in a proposal to start charging people, you know, co-pays. So we're talking about, you know, the lowest income families now having to pay, you know, every time they see a doctor, every time they get, you know, prescription drugs. And that proposal just went in last week. So those are some of the consequences, you know, of underfunding. And that's not even getting back into what happened last year, which is, you know, the provider rates were cut. And it prevents us from doing the things that we, you know, should be doing in Medicaid, too. And, you know, to the federal funding issue, that is a real problem. You know, if Medicaid isn't funded by $40 million in state funding, we get a 4-to-1 federal match. For every dollar the state puts in, you know, on average, we're getting $4 of federal matching funds. So if we fail to put in $40 million into the state Medicaid program, then we lose $160 million of federal matching funds. And as Dr. O'Donnell can, you know, speak about, who's here today, too, you know, that has a huge implication, not just for healthcare services, because we lose that much money out of our healthcare system, but also for the economy and jobs in New Mexico, too.
I want to go to Senator Stephen Neville. He's a Republican from Aztec. He's a member of the Legislative Finance Committee. Are you there, Senator Neville?
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Thanks for joining us. The health, as we heard, the Health and Human Services Department is seeking $42 million to maintain current services and avoid cuts. What are some of the options right now in the roundhouse that are being explored to find this money?
Well, there's a number of proposals out there to try to do some taxes on various medical procedures and so forth that have not been taxed in the past. And this is comes under the guise of restructuring, not so much new taxes, but applying taxes that already exist to other programs. That I don't know exactly what the numbers are at this point. We're still trying to evaluate that, whether that would help. But we're trying to do what we can to meet that $47 million shortfall It's very difficult. At the time that we instituted the Medicaid expansion, we were pretty flush. We had a lot of oil and gas income. Over time, oil and gas is our biggest industry in the state, and over time, we have just shifted the burden more and more to that industry. And anytime they have a downturn, and this has been the longest downturn in recorded history, as far as I know, that oil and gas has suffered. So it's been very, very difficult to try to keep the schools up to snuff and keep Medicaid funded and all of the other programs that the state's expected to provide.
What are your concerns, Senator Neville, about funding Medicaid this year and then going forward into the future?
Well, ultimately, this Medicaid expansion is going to cost the state something approaching $200 million. The previous speaker said something about it's a very small percentage. Percentage-wise, it is small, but when you look at something on the order of $2 billion in additional costs that the state is looking at in total Medicaid expansion, our share of that is 10%. 10% is $200 million. So that's a hard number for us to cover right now. We're a $6 billion budget, of which over a billion goes to Medicaid, $2.5 billion goes to schools. We don't have much left when it comes to it, so it's hard to go in and find other programs to cut, so our alternatives get kind of limited. It's a function of trying to figure some ways of enhancing our revenues or cutting. And when you cut, you not only does it affect Medicaid, it affects school children, it affects prisons, it affects the police forces. It has tremendous impacts when we can start having to look at cutting revenue or cutting expenditures.
We want to hear from you. Do you think Medicaid expansion has been good for New Mexico? Did you or someone you know get health care through Medicaid? How should the state pay for its share of the costs? Call now, 877-899-5866, or email callinshow@kunm.org. Also joining us today is Kelly O'Donnell. She's an economist and a research professor with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center for Health Policy at the University of New Mexico. Kelly, Senator Neville voiced a concern many people have in New Mexico about the ongoing cost of Medicaid, especially in the future. You have done an analysis of the economic benefits of Medicaid to the state. You've argued this expansion is benefiting New Mexico economically. We heard some of the health benefits. Why is it benefiting us economically?
Well, thank you for having me, by the way. The Medicaid expansion and health care in general benefits the New Mexico economy because health care is one of the primary, if not the primary, driver of job growth right now. When money from the federal government flows into New Mexico to fund Medicaid benefits, that money goes to providing health care, which in turn employs people. And that economic impact of to the healthcare sector radiates out through the state economy and creates jobs in all other sectors virtually and tax revenue. So when we talk about having a gap in Medicaid funding, what we're not looking at is the tax revenue that's being generated by that economic stimulus that comes from that federal contribution. And it's kind of funny that we don't explicitly factor that in when talking about whether there is enough revenue for Medicaid, because the fact of the matter is that cuts to Medicaid will actually cost the state more in terms of lost tax revenue and economic activity and jobs than it will save. So it's sort of stepping over dollars to pick up dimes.
So New Mexico gets federal funds to help pay for Medicaid. So for traditional Medicaid, quote unquote, mm-hmm. the costs are covered by about 70% by the federal government. For the Medicaid expansion, as we just heard, it's paying about 95% of the costs right now for those new premiums. So this is based on, I just want to make sure we're clear, how much we put into Medicaid. You're saying it's like if we don't put more in, we lose money.
Well, if we don't put the federal
government. Do we have to meet a threshold to get federal dollars, or it's just like you put in this, you get this?
No. Okay. At this level, it's a matching process. So when we put money in, they match those funds.
Okay. Senator Neville, what do you think about these arguments that while Medicaid seems to be draining our coffers, it might actually be helping our economy?
Well, that's a fact. There's no doubt about it. Anytime you have stimulus, any kind of dollars coming into the economy, it does stimulate jobs. It stimulates revenues. It hasn't proven out to be as lucrative as what we had hoped it would be. Whenever we first did the expansion, we thought that the increased revenues that we would generate would offset the cost and maybe even be a benefit above that. But that hasn't proven to be the case. We don't exactly know, to be real honest, what the net effect is. We're trying to analyze that as we go, but it's too new of a program. We haven't been able to fully identify when and where those dollars come in to offset some of the costs that we have to expend.
So among the various proposals for meeting these Medicaid obligations that are floating around right now, do you think one really makes sense and has a chance of making it through the legislature and getting the governor's signature?
That's still up in the air. We're analyzing them. There's various proposals to tax hospitals, to tax things that have been fairly well exempt from taxes. One of the things we did a number of years ago is we exempted food and medical from the tax rolls about, I think it's about 10, 15 years ago. That that is one of the biggest problems we have in our revenue stream is not only the medical, but the food. That put a big hole in our deal. At the time, again, we were very flush in oil and gas income, so everybody thought it would last forever. It didn't, and so now we've got a big hole to fill, and Medicaid is unfortunately, it's part of that hole.
Okay. Well, Senator Neville, I know it's a busy day at the Rent House, so I appreciate you joining us this morning. I'm going to let you go, but thank you so much for speaking with us.
You bet. Thank you. Bye.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be right back to talk more about how to pay for the Medicaid program in New Mexico.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting public radio KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated civil rights, criminal defense, wrongful death, security clearance, and Indian and family law cases throughout New Mexico. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support comes from the School for Advanced Research. Speaker Flag Miller explores the Bin Laden tapes and Al-Qaeda Thursday, January 26, 6:30 p.m. at the James A. Little Theater, Santa Fe. Tickets at lectures.sarweb.org.
I hate to let the facts get in the way of a fun story, but it's not true that Mozart wrote this while he was bowling. The piece has the nickname the Kegelstraat Trio, the Bowling Alley Trio, and whatever the inspiration, it's great music. Mozart and the Kegelstraat Trio on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. Today we're talking about how to pay for Medicaid. Did you or someone you know get health coverage thanks to the Medicaid expansion? Would you pay more taxes to ensure coverage continues for people who are eligible? Are you a provider who relies on patients covered by Medicaid? Could you absorb cuts to reimbursement rates? Call now 1-877-899-5866. You can also tweet us at KUNM News. We're live tweeting the show. And we repeatedly invited the State Human Services Department, which runs the Medicaid program, to join us for the show today, but they did not make anyone available to participate. So we cannot bring you that perspective on the program that will soon be helping around 900,000 people get access to health care in New Mexico. We do have Sarisha Mane with the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty. Sarisha, your organization has been lobbying for even more funding for Medicaid. So HSD is calling for $42 million. You're seeking more. Why? What are the other things that you want to see funded?
So we are trying to go back in time and try to get the program at a level, funding amount that it was last year. So last year, because of shortfalls in funding, we had cuts, deep cuts to payment rates to healthcare providers. And that's important to New Mexico for the reason that, you know, we need our healthcare providers in New Mexico to be able to provide the services. And if we underpay them, it's less likely that providers will see Medicaid patients, which we've already seen stories about that, or that they won't be able to have the kind of staffing that we need to be able to provide care. And that affects everybody, not just Medicaid patients, but everybody in New Mexico when you can't find a doctor, which, you know, people who live out in rural areas know that experience well. You know, those of us who are here in the city have had that experience in different ways, too. And so Medicaid, because it's such a cornerstone of our healthcare system, it's important, you know, that it pays adequately, you know, for the services that are provided. And so in addition to the $42 million, you know, in order to reinstate those, you know, provider payment rates, it would take some additional funding to be able to do that as well. So it's really just a matter of making the program as functional, you know, as the program, you know, should be and ought to be, which is extremely important right now, you know, especially as we're looking at possible changes to the program at the federal level. Mm-hmm. You know, New Mexico basically needs to get its funding house in order, you know, around Medicaid. And we think there's lots of sensible solutions to do that, you know. There's a lot of ways that our revenue system could be fixed. You know, our tax system is broken in so many ways, you know, because of all the different tax credits, exemptions that are given out, hundreds of millions of dollars that we're losing because of tax breaks that are, you know, frankly not fair for our families, the way that those, you know, things are designed. And that is really one of the problems that we have just around funding. You know, there's been a downturn in oil and gas, that's for sure. But one of the other issues is that we have a broken revenue system. Our tax system is not pulling in the money that it should be pulling in because we've given away too much money to folks in ways that were really not needed.
Kelly O'Donnell, you did this analysis about the economic impact of Medicaid here. And to what Sreesha is saying and what Senator Neville brought up, there seems to be a disconnect between it's bringing in these federal dollars, tax revenue, but there seems it's like not going to the place it needs to go to find the money to fund Medicaid. Talk about that a little bit more in terms of what she was saying regarding our tax system. And, you know, we're in an oil and gas downturn. How do we fund this? How do we fund even more? You guys want to expand home visiting with Medicaid. Our schools and our courts desperately need money.
Absolutely. Well, I think Senator Neville made an important point when he mentioned that the economic returns to the Medicaid expansion hadn't been quite as large as they had expected. And one of the reasons for that is that, you know, health insurance is really important. But if you can't get health care, if there aren't enough health care providers in your community, then it's not going to do you very much good. And what we have in New Mexico is a very severe shortage of all sorts of health care providers, and particularly in the rural areas. And so if people can't use their health insurance to obtain health care, then those economic impacts, the stimulus, is not really going to fully materialize. So that's one of the reasons that we're not seeing as great an impact from Medicaid as we could in the economy. But stepping back also to the question of revenue, we are not actually – we have a lot of opportunities to raise revenue. And it doesn't require enacting new taxes or taxing things we haven't taxed in the past. In fact, all we really need to do is revisit some of the decisions we've made about cutting taxes over the last 10 or 15 years. We made a bunch of really radical cuts to the personal income tax, to the gross receipts tax, to the corporate income tax, with the expectation that these would stimulate the economy. What we found was that they did not. And so having participated in this failed experiment, time has come to try and undo some of the damage by changing our tax system. And really, we know what works better because we've done it better in the past. And so changes to our baseline taxes, our personal income tax, making it more progressive would be a great way both to help families and to generate adequate revenue. But there seems to be a pathological fear of taxes. And in among policymakers, and we really just can't afford to run from the idea that we can generate adequate revenue from the basic revenue sources that we've relied on over the last 100 plus years.
So we have a caller right now. I wanted to see if we could take him. We have Steve, who was talking about the Richardson era tax break. Steve, are you there? What would you like to ask, or what would you like to say?
I am here. The Richardson-era tax breaks were put in when we were flush with oil money, and along with the removing the sales tax on food and such. And if we're talking about putting some of these, you know, rolling back these tax cuts, I would like to see a discussion of the Richardson-era tax breaks for people making $250,000 a year or more. I believe it's Senate Bill 50, which is currently stuck in the Senate Finance Committee.
Okay.
Anything anybody's got to say about that, I'd appreciate hearing. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. So there is an effort right now in the legislature, too.
There is. You know, there's a fairly consistent effort year after year. It just doesn't go very far because legislators are afraid to support what are considered tax increases, despite the fact that they are really just reversal of tax cuts that proved ineffective. And I think the caller makes a great point. The first place to look is in the personal income tax, make it more progressive. And we do that by eliminating some of the tax breaks at the very top and the deduction we implemented for capital gains.
I want to go to Representative Debbie Armstrong. She's on the phone with us from Santa Fe. Hello, Representative Armstrong.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we have around 44% of the population right now participating in Medicaid, or at least by the end of June, and 70% of our kids are born on Medicaid here. How should we see this? Are more people are getting covered? Or that we have a high poverty rate that means we have to rely on a government program for basic services and we need to raise taxes?
I think it's both.
Okay.
We had the Medicaid expansion really didn't impact the number of children particularly.
Right.
The Medicaid expansion added adults, and those were largely working adults, but we were already had a high number of children and, of course, seniors, people with disabilities. So we had a fairly high Medicaid rate anyways, but I think that it is partly an indication of the economy. And so as we develop and do economic development, I think we will see Medicaid rolls start to decline if we can get our economy going back again. So I think it is an indication of the economy.
How can we be sure that Medicaid is doing what it's supposed to? There was a report in the Santa Fe New Mexican last month about how difficult it is to figure out what kinds of health outcomes we're getting from Medicaid. I mean, is there a way to perhaps be more efficient or just make sure we're getting what we're paying for?
Well, a couple of things. One, the Medicaid expansion in particular, I would like to say those adults that we added to the Medicaid rolls were uninsured or largely uninsured before. And so there was probably a pent-up demand for some health care. And when you're in poverty, that's also a social indicator of health as well. And so you don't attend to your health as well. And there's other factors in your life that impact your health. So the fact that we had a big jump in Medicaid costs is not surprising to me. I also think that will settle over time as people get the health care that they need. But as far as tracking and seeing outcomes and what if we're getting what we're paying for, you also don't see results immediately. Just because you're now getting health care doesn't mean that it instantly shows up in any kind of tracking or data that there's an improved health outcome, because those largely take time to see those outcomes. There's also a lag in data, just because providers have up to, 6 to 6 months to bill for services. And then you need a baseline. And so particularly for those expanded adults, there wasn't a baseline. And so the first couple of years is developing a baseline, quite frankly, that then we can begin to track. And so it's easy to get frustrated really fast that we're not making any gains, and I think it's just a little too early to tell.
Okay, I want to take a call real quick from Bill. It goes to this question. I think he had a question about administrative costs. Are you there, Bill?
I am.
What
is my question?
Question
is about administrative costs. Is it true that patients in New Mexico Medicaid Centennial programs, are they divided into four separate managed care organizations which have their own administrative costs? And would there be savings if there were only one managed care organization for Centennial?
Kelly's shaking her head, and I'm guessing Dr. Madden might have an answer to that too. But
I would expect that if we gave a complete market control to a single health insurer, we probably wouldn't end up saving money. One of the things to keep in mind, however, is that there is a limit on the cost, the administrative cost an MCO can take from its Medicaid funding. And that's that, you know, that's imposed equally on all of the insurers.
Okay. And Representative Armstrong, I know that President Donald Trump and Republicans in Congress are talking about repealing the ACA. You have a bill with Representative Roberto Gonzalez of Taos right now called the Health Security Act that's supposed to respond to those plans?
The Health Security Act has been proposed for a long time. In the early days, 20 years ago, it was called the single payer plan. But it is, for me, I think the timing is right to look at that, just so for the comment that we just had from the caller, to look at how we're spending our public dollars and whether we can more efficiently pool resources, administration, bargaining power, if you will, design a system for New Mexico, particularly if, as part of the federal initiative, they block grant Medicaid. That's a talk. We don't know whether they will do that or not, which would mean just give the state their, you know, a set pot of money to do their Medicaid program as they want. And so we have lots of public employees, plus almost half the state on Medicaid, and I think it's time to look at how we spend those dollars and could we spend it more efficiently, effectively. And so the first part of the bill and proposal is to do that study. And if it looks like a different system for New Mexico would be more cost-effective and feasible, then it would move forward. And if the study shows that it doesn't, then actually the whole thing repeals and it doesn't go anywhere.
I want to take a call from Donald. I think it might go to this subject. Donald, you had a question about expanding health care statewide?
Yes, ma'am. I think beyond just doing a single payer for Medicaid, it would be worth considering having universal health care statewide, similar to what Colorado attempted last year, which didn't pass, but I think it's inevitably something that states and even the nation might come to consider.
Representative Armstrong, is that sort of what you're looking at with this bill? Is that even possible right now in this political atmosphere?
Well, I don't know that it's possible nationwide. For the state, we can, you know, universal coverage to the extent we can. We can't control federal employees. We can't control veterans. We can't force Indian Health Services. So there are other programs and payers and self-insured employers who I don't think we could force into the system. But we do, as I said, we spend a lot of money on Medicaid and public employees that we can at least look that far and then how private sector could participate.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Armstrong. I appreciate you joining us this morning. And we've got a busy
Thanks
day at
for
the
having
Roundhouse.
Me.
Thanks a lot. This is the KUNM call-in show. We're talking about how to pay for the Medicaid system, which provides coverage for more than 900,000 people in the state since it was expanded under the Affordable Care Act. Have you gotten health coverage under Medicaid? What would changes to the program mean for you and your family? Are you a healthcare provider who relies on Medicaid to cover your patients' costs? Call 877-899-5866 or email callinshow@kunm.org. We have a couple of Twitter comments. Comment from Ivy. She says one of the effects of changing the Medicaid system in New Mexico would be that some people will have to go across the border to Juarez, Mexico, for medical care. Also, comment from David. He says he thinks there's too much money going to the managed care companies to coordinate Medicaid services without evidence that they improve outcomes for patients. Also from Mariah, she has heard that people are being enrolled in Medicaid, but that some people are only receiving partial or limited coverage. Is this happening? Is it only new enrollees? Are others having their services cut? Sarisha, do you know anything about that?
I haven't heard much about that. You know, most people who are eligible for Medicaid get full coverage through the program. You know, there's some limited service categories. For example, you know, some folks who can just get family planning through Medicaid and then get other insurance through other means, or for certain pregnant women where Medicaid will cover just the pregnancy-related services. You know, but for the most part, if you enroll in Medicaid, you're eligible for the full range of services.
Kelly, if the Affordable Care Act was repealed and the expansion of Medicaid to include more low-income adults was undone, what would be the impact here?
Well, if it wasn't replaced with something equally beneficial to the state, which I suspect it wouldn't be, it would be catastrophic. It would be catastrophic for that large population of people who just barely got health care for the first time in perhaps their lifetime. But it would also be a huge blow to the state economy and to our health care sector. It would be a giant step backwards, both socially and economically.
Dr. Rick Madden in Belen. So one of the things that HSD is proposing is co-pays and deductibles for Medicaid plans to help with this funding. What do you think about that?
Oh, thanks for asking. I think the proposal was a requirement from the state legislature a couple of years ago to the HSD Human Services Department that they at least consider co-pays and deductibles to offset some of the costs and also to incentivize patients seeking care to be sure that they really needed that care at that level. So the outpatient suggestion for a co-pay was, I think, $5 per visit, excluding children on CHIP, you know, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and disabled working and people who were not able to afford it. So it is means tested. There's a co-payment for $50 for a hospital stay that's being proposed, emergency transportation that's not an emergent, prescription drugs that are not generic or higher.
Now, these are pretty common in private health care plans, right?
Yeah, that's true. But when you're talking about in a disadvantaged population, people who are on Medicaid expansion, they're just barely making ends meet. They got insurance because they were able to get help either through Medicaid expansion or for the those who were above 138% of the federal poverty level, they could get a break from the government with a subsidy. But if you impose copays, the big problem from my point of view, and I see this in my practice all the time, is people will not access care. They won't come in until it's late. And that's a big barrier. Even a small copay can do that to people who are living on the edge economically. And it also, to me, is basically the providers of care, doctors, hospitals, et cetera, are going to basically eat that cost. If they can't collect that copay and they can't turn patients away, which I think they ethically would not do, then they eat the cost of the copay, and that's basically a tax on the providers, both hospitals, doctors, offices.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be right back.
It's time to elect four people to the KUNM Radio Board, and you're invited to nominate yourself. We welcome people from all walks of life. People from various backgrounds are encouraged, and a broad array of points of view and philosophies are welcome. Nominations must be in by 5 p.m. February 20th, mailed or delivered to University Secretary, Scholes Hall, UNM, 87131. For more information on the KUNM Radio Board elections, call 277-4664 or visit kunm.org/about.
Fresh produce is a key to healthy cooking. And there's no place like the backyard garden or local farm to get the freshest vegetables and fruits. Native gardeners and farmers are working hard to feed their communities, but not without facing obstacles. We'll hear more on this on the next Native America Calling. And if you have a garden, we want to hear from you, too.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show, and we're talking about Medicaid and how the state can find money for the program when there's a budget crunch. Is Medicaid important to you? Are you concerned it's going to cost the state too much? How should we pay for it? You can still call us at 877-899-5866. Follow us on Twitter. You can message us there at KUNM News. And John has been holding for a bit, so I want to go to him. John from Santa Fe, are you still there? Oh, I think John left us. Okay. Well, we also have on the phone Steve Koppelman. He's executive director of the New Mexico Association of Counties. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Megan. Thank you for having me.
Steve, the Human Services Department Secretary Brent Earnest has proposed taking money that county governments use to pay for indigent health care and adding it to the Medicaid budget. What are these funds and what are they used for?
Okay, there is a gross receipts tax, local increments, and almost all the counties have approved a number of them, including the second 1/8, which is specifically earmarked and geared for indigent health care services in that particular county. So almost all the counties have implemented that second 1/8 GRT. A lot of counties supplement their indigent health care fund because that's not enough money to pay for all of the different programs that the counties are supporting. So, for example, right now, all counties pay a 1/16th equivalent GRT, which I think comes out to roughly about $28 million, and that goes specifically to the Medicaid program, and then that money is used for the match with the federal government with CMS. So that that money goes and comes back to the state. In addition to that, the counties pay roughly $24 million into what's called the safety net care pool. And that money specifically goes into two pools that are administered by the HSD, the Human Services Department. Part of it goes to assist local hospitals in paying for uncompensated care. And then the other portion of that money goes for increasing Medicaid base rates for hospitals. In addition to that, counties, some counties have also imposed special hospital gross receipts taxes or mill levies. Like Bernalillo County, for example, and Socorro County have fairly substantial mill levies that go toward health care and the Medicaid program. And so the counties serve a really, really important role because, for example, we have working poor people who are not enrolled in Medicaid and maybe haven't or aren't eligible for the Affordable Care Act program. And so the counties provide health care for these folks. In addition, we have thousands and thousands of inmates in our county jails that even if they are being covered by Medicaid, once they get arrested, whether they're convicted or not, even though they're pre-adjudicatory, the counties are responsible for providing for their health care. So that's a huge number of people also.
So there's all these costs that Medicaid isn't covering. You're saying that you guys still have to cover? Okay. So you oppose this idea of you would like the state to not tap into these indigent care funds.
Well, one of the big problems is that counties have, to differing degrees, a lot of local programs. And you're probably aware that Bernalillo County has imposed a new 1/8 GRT increment that's exclusively geared for behavioral health. And that's a huge gap in the coverages now. So a lot of counties have very special behavioral health programs, you know, everything from mobile crisis response teams. We're seeing more crisis triage centers coming up. But the behavioral health issue is a huge one. And really, county governments have been filling the gap in that. And so one of the big problems with the proposal that you talked about is that a lot of these local programs would be decimated. And it would leave an incredible gap. And like I said, especially in areas like behavioral health and other healthcare services for indigent population. And that could include everything from primary care to home health services, hospice, and the like. So it would be a real, a huge problem for the community. And I don't think the ramifications of that proposal have been looked at all, to be honest with you, by HSD.
So do you feel like you're getting, are these concerns being listened to by lawmakers or by HSD? I mean, is there a way to get more of these services covered under Medicaid so the burden's not on the county?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're working on with several counties are pilot programs where we're looking at working regionally with a number of different counties on putting together some Medicaid-covered programs. And that we're going to need to sit down with HSD and look into whether those programs can be included in the upcoming Medicaid waiver that the state does with CMS.
Okay.
But, you know, at this point, the counties are really providing a laundry list of services, really important ones, again, for our most vulnerable residents in the state. And the problem with taking that money from these programs would be, you know, leaving a huge, huge gap, and it would be catastrophic, frankly.
I wanted to add again, we did repeatedly invite the Human Services Department, which runs the Medicaid program, to join us on the show today. They did not make anyone available to participate, so we can't bring you their perspective for this program. Steve Koppelman with the Association of Counties, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks very much, Megan.
I want to go to Bill in Los Lunas. Bill, you wanted to talk about why we must rely on federal funds?
Yes, we're $41 million short to receive the federal funds. It's quite simple. Through the regulations of the federal fund, because we are one of the poorest states in the nation, if not the poorest, to receive the federal funds, we draw $41 million from the super fund to get the federal funds through their regulations that it's applied to Medicare. Then when we get the federal funds, we return the $41 million back to the super fund with a little bit of interest. Now we have $120 million from the federal fund that's in the state applying to Medicare. The $41 million was applied to Medicare, so then it all applies to the federal regulations.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bill. We also have David from Albuquerque, who personally benefited from the Medicaid expansion. Are you there, David?
Yes, I'm here.
What did you want to say?
So, yeah, I personally benefited because I'm a graduate student here at UNM. I'm from southern New Mexico, and I'm over 26 now. I'm 28. And because of the Medicaid expansion, I'm able to have Centennial Care and afford graduate school a lot more because I don't have to contribute on my own personal finances to buying coverage.
And what is that made a big difference for you in terms of being able to pursue an advanced degree?
Yeah, for sure. Like, so it makes it a big difference for one, because I don't have to take out student loans to cover that amount. There are programs here at UNM for assistantships that could provide you with health coverage, but just due to the overall cuts in the state budget and generally, that also affects UNM and the amount of assistantships available. So the student employment that I have is hourly, and it doesn't actually provide health insurance. So that's something I would have to come up with on my own.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling, David. Kelly, that's interesting. You talked about the economic benefits of Medicaid. That's probably something that didn't even pop up on your numbers, maybe.
It's hugely important because it speaks to how productive our economy is. And to the not only does having affordable access to health insurance free up resources to gain new skills, perhaps even work more hours, it also is very beneficial in the long term. I love that we're talking to a 28-year-old man who's actually getting health care, because getting preventative care when you're young is a great way to prevent really costly health problems down the road. And that ultimately saves the entire state money. So we have somebody who's getting more education, who is going to be more productive, whose health is likely to be better in the long term, and thus he's likely to impose less cost on the overall healthcare system. So there's so many different levels of benefit from providing access to affordable health care to as many people as possible.
And I want to go to one more caller we have from Santa Fe. Nat, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you for discussing this subject. The reason that I'm calling is when health care is not available to individuals and they're in a really serious situation, and you've heard this in the news, they may resort to crime to be able to access the funds, to be able to provide emergency care to a loved one or maybe even to themselves. And I think that that's doing a disservice to our community when we're really dealing with a heightened level of crime. I also wanted to bring up one quick thing about the gentleman who just called in. He, having an advanced degree, will go forward and earn a better income, be a contributing member to the tax base, and help support the Medicaid program through the mill levies and taxes of that nature. So thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for calling, Nat. Sarisha, your group has been advocating for a higher level, the Center on Law and Poverty, a higher level of Medicaid funding. And one argument has to do with future moves in Washington, which we don't know yet. But there have been discussions about turning this program into a block grant. So your organization argues if that happens, current state funding levels would set the baseline for future funding, federal funding levels. So what does that mean?
Correct. So one of the proposals that's floating around Congress and is part of a lot of the major sort of congressional proposals to change Medicaid is to turn the program into what's called a block grant. So instead of matching the $4 to every $1 that the state gives in or puts into the program, instead it would be one fixed amount of money that would be given to the state to be able to pay for Medicaid. And then they would set a baseline amount, so it would start 1 year with a fixed amount of money, and then every year after that, the amount of funding that would go to Medicaid would only increase just very incrementally. And the idea of doing this is to basically, try to save the federal government costs. You know, the idea is in one of the proposals, they would cut federal funding for Medicaid by 50%, over 10 years. And so what that means for states is a really dangerous situation because it means that states are going to have to pick up that cost, that the federal government doesn't pay for, or they're going to have to cut services. So either cut, entire populations off of Medicaid or start cutting services, in different respects. So, if that happens, with the block grant program, it's even more important that New Mexico get our funding house in order, to be able to support healthcare services, or else we're going to have to make some really difficult decisions and potentially deal with even more costs, in the future from not having people insured and other costs. But also in this first year, this baseline year, when federal government decides how much, funding to give New Mexico, one of the ways that they would likely do this is by looking at how much they provide to New Mexico now. So if we're not, providing the full program that we're supposed to be providing, if we're not paying our providers at the rate they're supposed to be paid, if we're not offering the services that we should be offering in Medicaid, we're basically setting ourselves up because we're going to get a lower amount of federal funding than we ought to get, and that would be the baseline for the block grant moving forward. So we don't want to threaten our program for future years. We want to get our program as strong as we can get it now.
Dr. Rick Madden and Belen, I mean, theoretically, a block grant gives the state more control over funds to be innovative. Kelly's shaking her head, but I wanted to ask you, I mean, because you talked about people might be unwilling to do copays. Anyway, quickly, is there any kind of upside in doing something like that?
Well, there's a lot of leeway within the current waiver that we have with the Centennial Care Program. It's called the 1115 waiver for Medicaid, and that has allowed a lot of innovation. We have actually a model program. I don't know if we can improve on that with a block grant because almost certainly the costs would be transferred to states, and that would mean as time goes by, we would have less money and not be able to do what we need to do.
Kelly, as we go forward, we're almost out of time, but there are no easy answers here, because there doesn't seem to be money anywhere. And now lawmakers are talking about maybe we need to raise taxes. The governor has pretty adamantly said she doesn't want that. What do you think going forward we're gonna have to do to make this work?
Well, I think that we have to get a little more courageous at the executive level and say, look, it's in the best interest of the people of New Mexico to have more revenue and to generate it in a way that makes sense. And that means looking at our base taxes, personal income tax, corporate income tax, gross receipts tax. Raising taxes is not a crime. And in some instances, it's absolutely the best and most beneficial thing to do.
Well, that's all the time we have today. I want to thank my guest, Senator Steve Neville, Representative Debbie Armstrong, Steve Koppelman with the Mexico Association of Counties, Kelly O'Donnell with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center on Health Policy here at UNM, Sarisha Manet with the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty, and Dr. Rick Madden. He's a doctor in Belen, New Mexico. The conversation can continue on Twitter. Follow at KUNM News. You can also share your comments on the KUNM call-in show page at KUNM.org. We have more links and resources there as well. Our engineer today was Marino Spencer. Sarah Trujillo screened your calls. Anna Landy live tweeted the show. And Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. Next Thursday morning at 8, we'll look at how lawmakers are trying to fund education this year. We'll continue our coverage with the People Power and Democracy Project, which explores ethics, transparency, and good government. It's funded by the Thornburg Foundation and by you, our KUNM listeners. Thanks for joining us. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is KUNM.